Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club and the moderator for tonight's program. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest. The Honorable Ellen Tauscher serves as the Member of Congress for this district, the 10th Congressional District of California. She has had an extraordinary career, learning, mastering, and then leading in many different fields, each of which would have been enough to compose a remarkable life. Ellen Tauscher was born in Newark, New Jersey. Her mom was a secretary and her dad a shop steward for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. The first member of her family to attend college, she graduated in 1974 from Seton Hall University, where she obtained a Bachelor of Science degree in early childhood education. Then she began career number one on Wall Street. She worked as an investment banker with Bache & Company and at age 25 became a member of the New York Stock Exchange. She was one of the first women to hold a seat on the exchange and the youngest at that time. She also served as an officer of the American Stock Exchange, after which she worked for Bear Stearns and then a subsidiary of Drexel Burnham. In 1989, Representative Tauscher moved here to our beautiful region and began career number two as an entrepreneur. When she was looking for quality child care for her daughter, she founded the first national research service to help parents verify the background of child care workers. She also published the Child Care Sourcebook and headed the Tauscher Foundation, which provided funds for elementary schools to buy computers and internet access. In 1996, she ran for Congress, beginning career number three. Drawing on her prior experiences, as well as the strengths and needs of her district, she has provided significant leadership on several key issues. The only member of Congress with two national laboratories in her district, she has played an important role in national policies on nuclear weapons, energy policy, scientific research, and other areas in which the labs work. Serving on the House Armed Services Committee, she currently chairs its Subcommittee on Strategic Forces and has worked to prevent the spread of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. Congresswoman Ellen Tauscher is also a senior member of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, where she's worked to improve our roads, mass transit, tunnels, and other infrastructure, both nationally and here locally. She's provided leadership on cutting-edge projects like high-speed rail, now not just a priority for California, but the whole nation. Representative Tauscher is the chair of the House New Democrat Coalition, at 67 members, the largest coalition of centrist Democrats in Congress. The New Dems, as they're called, focus on maintaining U.S. competitiveness, meeting the challenges posed by globalization, and strengthening our national security. She, of course, draws on her business background in leading the New Democrats' focus on a strong U.S. economy. Time magazine has called the moderate Democratic philosophy she's established Tauscherism. An advocate for working families and businesses, Congresswoman Tauscher has played a crucial role in many of the New Democrats' signature programs. She co-authored a major prescription drug plan and has introduced the State Infrastructure Banks for Schools Act to provide innovative approaches to rebuild our nation's aging public schools and libraries. As you know, because of the leadership she has demonstrated in the fields of nonproliferation, nuclear weapons policies, and homeland security, she is about to begin her fourth career, having been nominated to serve as Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, a very senior U.S. government post handling those issues. Since this is my field and I know how well qualified she is for this position, I am personally delighted at her nomination. Please join me in congratulating her. Congresswoman Ellen Tauscher lives here in our hometown of Lafayette and is the mom of an 18-year-old daughter, Catherine. We also welcome her fiancé, Jim Cieslak, who is here with us this evening. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to the Honorable Ellen Tauscher.
Thank you very much, Gloria, for that very kind introduction, and coming from you with such a fabulous pedigree of so many years working in the arms control arena, having been an Assistant Secretary of Defense in this area, thank you for the compliment. And I just want to remind you, if you want to return to that kind of work for less pay and more stress, you know where to find me.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, good evening, everyone. It's really wonderful to be home. And when I originally agreed to do this, I thought I was going to be here at home for the Memorial Day break, taking a few days off and spending time with my friends and family, my constituents, talking about what's going on in Washington. And then, as you know, sometimes events overtake you. When I was asked in March to consider being the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, I thought about it a lot because, frankly, I have a pretty cushy job. I work for the smartest people in the world who happen to live in the 10th Congressional District. I have a beautiful place to come when I leave Washington. My party is in the control of the House, so I not only get to chair a great subcommittee and lead a group of moderate Democrats to support the agenda of both the President and the Speaker. I get to preside every once in a while. Gloria took her gavel with her, but I get to preside over the House every once in a while, which is very cool because my parents get to watch. And, of course, my mother has a running commentary with me about my hair. And my father, of course, if anybody should ever stand up and look like they are not absolutely respecting the gavel, my father threatens to get on an airplane and go get them. And it might, you know, from my point of view at 81, he probably could. So I just wanted to, because the agenda has changed, because I have been nominated to be undersecretary and I am in a quiet period, we can talk about things generally about nonproliferation and other things, but really what I wanted to do was take this opportunity as I'm waiting and waiting for my Senate hearing, which is on June 9th, I'd like to take this opportunity to really talk about what it's been like to be here. It had originally been my intention to say I do only once in June of this year. Jim and I are getting married on June 27th. He has made me the happiest woman in the world, and I couldn't be happier to be marrying him. But apparently, I may actually be saying I do to be Undersecretary of State if I'm confirmed by the Senate. But we'll fit all that in. My daughter's graduating in a few weeks. When I ran for Congress in 1996, Catherine was 5 years old. She was in kindergarten at Dars Eaton School. And because I wanted to be a good mom and a good member, I brought her to Washington. So she has lived in Washington ever since. She's gone to the National Cathedral School, and she is actually graduating next Saturday, the 7th. She is going to Bucknell University to play Division I volleyball. And that's exactly what I promised her I would tell people. She said, Mommy, if anybody asks where I'm going to college, please tell them I'm going to Bucknell University to play Division I volleyball. She's also going to study psychology, in case anybody cares. But when Catherine and I went to Washington in the beginning, it was an amazing time. It was 1996, January of 1997. One of the first things I did was go to Bill Clinton's second inauguration. I went to Congress to get sworn in a few weeks earlier. It was the day that Newt Gingrich was actually assessed a historic $300,000 fine for some shenanigans. And we effectively sat for 4.5 hours, everybody, our friends and family, the whole Congress, 435 members. We all sat there waiting to get sworn in, which was one of those little fast ceremonies at the end because nobody was really happy with each other. And then the Congress became quite an interesting place to be. There was a lot of hostility, Republican-led Congress, Bill Clinton in the presidency. A few times when we were voting in the evening, I would bring Catherine to the floor with me. I would give her my voting card. We have electronic voting cards, and there are three buttons, red, no, green, yes, yellow, present. And I would say to her, okay, honey, take the card and you can vote for me. And she'd say, which one? And I'd say, red. We're going to vote no. And so she would hit red. And then my other colleagues would come over and give them cards, and she'd hit red, red, red. Red, 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 red. And then we lost, you know. And she'd look up and she'd say, "We lost." And I'd say, "Yeah." And the second time she did it, red, 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 "We lost." So at the third vote, I said to her, "Okay, honey, are you ready?" And she said, "You know, Mommy, if I hit the green button, we win." And I said, "Sweetheart, I adore you, but I am going to break your heart. We're never going to vote yes. This is just, we're not for what they're for." And she said, "Tell me about that." And I said, "Well, you know, we just have different points of view. And, you know, I'm not supporting what they're for. They're not for what the president's for. I'm kind of for what he's for. So I'm probably going to get to vote no a lot." So certainly now that we are in the majority and we have a Democratic president, things have changed. We vote yes a lot, which is not a bad thing. But I just wanted to kind of quickly go through how things have changed. In 1996, when I won, I ran in a district where everyone told me I couldn't beat the incumbent. And with support from at least 51% of you, I did. And then I went to Congress, and because I take a business-like attitude for most things that I do, it was clear to me that in this district, with the home of two national labs, at the time it had Camp Parks, didn't have Travis, now has Travis and doesn't have Camp Parks, but still has the two national nuclear labs, and with the kind of congestion that we have, I launched myself like Velcro Girl with the help of Nancy Pelosi, who was not even in leadership at the time, to get a seat on the Transportation Committee and the promise that I would get a seat on the Armed Services Committee when one became available. A few months after we were in Congress, Ron Dellums decided to retire, and a seat on the Armed Services Committee became available. So I became the only member from the Northern California to be both on Transportation and Armed Services. And I did that not because I thought it was a great thing to do or that was interesting work. It was because of the work that was needed for my constituents. You can go to Congress and do what you want, especially if you have a safe seat. I was lucky. I didn't have a safe seat. And it was very clear to me that in order to do the work that I believed I needed to do for my own ethics, but also to serve my constituents, that I had to be in places that were going to serve them best. So that's why for the last 12 and a half years I've been both on the Armed Services Committee and the Transportation Committee. When lightning struck in November of 2006 and the Democrats won the majority, I became the chairman of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee. It's got $50 billion of authorizing authority. We do missile defense, nuclear weapons, space and satellites, and a lot of things that if I told you about them, I'd have to kill you. I spend a lot of time getting dragged into a room where there are no electronics, and they tell me things. I think they're trying to shock me, and I keep reminding them that I'm 57 years old and I was born in Newark, New Jersey. So I have, for the last 13 years, been enormously blessed and humbled and honored through seven elections to been returned to Congress by my constituents to represent them. And I've taken those words really to heart. So I just very briefly want to tell you what my operating philosophy has been while I've been in Congress, and this is what I hope to take with me should I be confirmed to the State Department. I've always had three C's that I've kept in my head. The first is the Constitution. I wear this pin, and I take an oath to defend the Constitution. I take an oath to protect the American people. And there are a number of different responsibilities that the Congress is given specific to the Constitution. We're meant to build the Army and the Navy. We're the only ones that are meant to assess taxes and raise taxes. We're the only ones that are supposed to create a Commerce Department. Obviously, things have changed since the very beginning when those wise men, supported by some very smart women, created this country. But to me, the first rule of law had to be the Constitution. So I've done my best to make sure that what I support is not only constitutional, but it is really in line and congruent with what I believe is the best thing for my constituents. The second C that I pay attention to is my conscience. I like to sleep at night. I believe that there are many decisions that we make in the Congress that are not very open for the American people to look and evaluate. There's a lot of opaqueness. Some of it's because of the issue. Some of it's because of expediency. And sometimes it's because issues are very polarizing. What disturbs me the most about politics today is that it is very much he said, she said. Unlike you, because you are the smartest people in the world, too many people in this state, and frankly in the other 49 states, don't pay attention to what's going on. They're very easily led by a 30-second ad or a whispering campaign or misinformation. And they certainly can be scared to death. And we've had a lot of scaring to death over the last 10 years or so, certainly since September 11th of 2001. But I've been blessed because the people I work with can be scared, but they're not ever going to be scared to do something that is crazy. So my responsibility, and to make sure that my conscience was safe and sound, was to make sure that what I did really represented what I believe my constituents wanted me to do. So I've made some pretty tough decisions over the years. And I've been able to square them because I've been able to come home and look at my constituents, either in the Safeway or at the Nordstrom shoe department, or out to dinner or in formal meetings, and listen to them and really believe that I understand what they're saying. A mistake members make is they go to Congress and they think that because they have proximity and because they're in hearings and because they know people, that they actually know more than their constituents and know better than their constituents. And that's not the job of a representative. A representative's job, I believe, is to be one who listens, even when it's hard to do, and still acts in a way that is responsible to the people that they are going to go back and listen to again, and to do it again, and to do it again. The third C is obviously my constituents. So if I can balance the Constitution, my conscience, with my constituents' needs and desires, I was able to sleep at night. And I've slept pretty good and pretty well for the last 13 years. I have, in my life, been enormously blessed. My parents are still alive. I have two sisters and a brother. My brother, the baby Jesus, is just a really wonderful young man, but he was 9 years younger than me, and so I feel like he's in another family. But my two sisters and I are very close, and I'm marrying a man that I absolutely adore. My daughter's going to play volleyball. The world is perfect. And now the president has asked me to do a tough job, but one that I think I'm capable of doing. Because I have worked for you for all of these years, and because I listened to you, and because I did what I thought you wanted me to do. And if I can continue to work for you in this new job and serve you the way I think I have been able to for the last 12 and a half years, I think things will be better. But I will need your help to do that. So although I may not be the member of Congress from the 10th Congressional District when I resign after I'm hopefully confirmed, I still want to hear from you. I still need to know what you're thinking, because I do believe you are the smartest people in the world, not because you've elected me seven times, which is a nice coincidence, but because of your background, because of your compassion, because of your hard work, because you value the things that I value: hard work, honesty, integrity, working with others and for others. And I really am here to thank you for the honor and privilege of working for you for the last 12 and a half years. It has enhanced my life. It has changed my life. It has blessed me beyond anything I can tell you. And I'll never forget it. I'll never forget what you invested in me. And now I'm going to take that and invest it in all of our names for what I hope is a great agenda for the president on nonproliferation and other issues, arms control, for the betterment of everyone. So I know that Gloria has some questions, and I'm happy to hear from you. Thanks again for being here tonight.
Thank you so much, Congresswoman Tauscher. And yes, we have many questions. In fact, your constituents have many questions.
Right.
I'd like to start off with one of my own, though, which struck me as I was looking through your biography again and really recognizing how many different areas you've worked in. You've mastered such different fields, Wall Street, finance, to nuclear nonproliferation. What is your process for choosing an issue, deciding what you're concerned about, what you're interested in. What's your process then for becoming informed about it and then choosing how you're going to approach it to change things as a leader?
Well, I think if you saw the snail mail that we used to get now, emails and phone calls that I get from my constituents, you could understand the breadth of concerns they have, of the ability to analyze issues, the sophistication of the questions that they ask. And that's always been fascinating to me, that in my constituency we have so many people that are just really extraordinarily caring about the world. They don't come here just to live in a beautiful place. They weren't born here because it's just a nice place to raise children. Many people have chosen to come here. They've come back after they've gone. They've been IBM'd, I've been moved, or they've had a successful career someplace else. People come back here to retire. I know that your mom is here and your brother. Hi, how are you? Nice to see you. So I think that I found that my constituents really had very, very big demands. And I'm a curious person. I always liked reading when I was growing up. I was somebody that had bad allergies, so I didn't go outside a lot, so I sat and read. And I felt that I had the capacity to analyze things, and that's probably my only real talent. So when I figured out that I could understand things and then get the answer, and then I could actually message it back to my constituents in a way that a lot of people could understand, I thought that that was a way for me to be effective.
You ran for Congress first in 1996, was it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what activated you? What made you decide to go for an elected office? Was there something that happened where you just said, I'm so mad about this, or I want to do something about this?
Well, I was very blessed. When I came to California in 1989, my former husband and I bought a computer company, and I was introduced to Dianne Feinstein, who was running for governor. You know, she narrowly lost to Pete Wilson in 1990. And I just found Dianne to be such a compelling person and such an interesting person, and I still think she's one of the finest persons I've ever met. And so we became friends. When she ran for the Senate in 1992, she asked me to be one of her honorary co-chairs for her campaign. And so I got to meet lots of people in California politics. And in 1993 or 4, I was at a lunch and somebody said, you know, somebody really should go beat Bill Baker. And I said, well, you know, it's going to have to be somebody that, you know, has this kind of personality and this kind of background and stuff. So I got in my car and was driving over the Bay Bridge, and my car phone rang, and whoever it was said to me, we're still here at lunch, and we think it was you. You've described yourself. So the lesson is never leave the lunch. Never leave when there are people there that may be conspiring against you. And I said, oh, no. I said, no. I wasn't talking about myself. I said, absolutely not. But by 1996, I thought that it was my time to do public service. My father was a borough councilman in our little town. I grew up in Hudson County, New Jersey, where the dead voted Democratic. I didn't even know what a general election was until I was in high school. I remember the first time I met a Republican, and I was like, isn't that interesting? But, you know, I thought that I could add value. I thought that I could make this this district that at the time was very much evenly split between Democrats and Republicans, that I could represent both fairly well, and that's why I offered myself up.
If you could cite the accomplishment after more than a dozen years of which you're most proud now leaving the Congress, but that you accomplished during your time in Congress, what would that be? And why would you choose that particular accomplishment?
Well, it's raising my daughter. I know that somebody wants me to say it was H.R. 2755, and, you know, it passed unanimously, and everybody's happy about that bill. But, you know, I'm just like everybody else. I was working very hard and became a single mom, and then all of a sudden, you know, had this job and had to kind of square it with my daughter and raise her. And so she's still my work of art, and she's still, I think, the best thing about my life, is being able to have work that I found to be interesting and rewarding, and to be able to still be a fairly good mom, and have her still talk to me. So I think that's the test. So I think that's pretty much it. But I would say, legislatively, in the last few years as chairman of Strategic Forces, we've been able to make missile defense a much more congruent part of our national security strategy, not an ideologically based one. And too much of that during the Bush administration was ideologically based. And I also think that my advocacy for the national labs is something that I really believe was a cornerstone of my ability to represent my constituents. I think it's, for those of you that don't know, there's so much about who we are here that is so much about those labs. These are people that are absolute patriots. They are some of the smartest people on the planet. And they are your neighbors and friends and relatives and people that are very, very opaque to many of us. People don't see them as people that work at labs. And there's men and women and generations of families that have worked there. And they have really immeasurably added to our national security. And they are some of the finest people I've ever met.
Those who work at the labs or are familiar with the labs know this, but I agree with you. Most people think that the only thing the national labs do are weapons development, and they do so much more. They are leaders in supercomputing, for instance.
Right.
For all purposes, not just national defense. They do a lot of the work in nonproliferation. They were the essentially made a lot of the equipment and material that in my time we provided to the former Soviet countries to dismantle their weapons of mass destruction. So they're actually involved in nonproliferation and reducing nuclear weapons well. So I couldn't agree with you more.
Thank you.
You, when you talked about running against Bill Baker and the thought that person of a certain type and philosophy was needed, and that described you. You have brought a pretty unique philosophy to the Democratic Party. You've really been a leader in establishing a centrist, moderate, and economic growth-oriented wing in the Democratic Party, the New Democrat approach. Could you describe that philosophy? How would you characterize that?
Well, New Dems are very strong Democrats. We're progressive Democrats, but for many of us, we represent constituencies very much like this district here. Very highly educated districts. Many of them are surrounding universities or surrounding research parks. So you're going to find people that are near Silicon Valley, near Research Park in North Carolina, up and down both coasts and in the central part of the country. They tend to be districts that are suburban or exurban, where there's a lot of entrepreneurship, lots of college graduates, lots of people with advanced degrees. These are people that want public policy that is aided by politics, not politics that does sometimes do public policy. And they tend to be called swing voters, and they are people that don't get up in the morning and decide whether they're, you know, a Democrat or a Republican. They're looking for a person that resonates with them, that speaks to their issues, who is effective, and they forgive us for the fact that we do politics too. You know, many of us are, as I said, I'm a genetic Democrat, but you know, for many of us, politics really cuts both ways, and the partisanship that we see in Washington that is so corrosive and causes sometimes so little to get done, has got to be abated by public policy. And there have to be people that are willing to stand in the breach and say, I'm not going to be for anything, but I might be for something. Do you have something to tell me? Do you have something to offer me? Do you have something you might want to do? So of course, New Dems are constantly lambasted as being, you know, Democrat light and all that. And the truth of the matter is, it's very easy to be a very strong partisan of either party. You don't have a lot of imagination to do that. It takes a lot of imagination and, frankly, a lot of intestinal courage to decide that you're going to say to your own party, wait a second, that's good, but it could be better. And we still have a lot of people in this country that believe that things that are just voted on by Democrats and opposed by Republicans, or the opposite, that there's still improvement that can be done in that bill, that there should be a way to get some people to come across the line. Now, in defense of my own party, I will tell you that the other party has eaten their own. They have worked diligently, my friends in the Republican Party, have worked diligently over the years to excise moderate Republicans. They have sacrificed them on the altar of purity. And I hope my party never does that. The nice thing about Democrats is that we are a very big tent, and we're very tolerant, and we can count. And we're on the ascendancy, I believe, because we've figured out how to be tolerant at the same time, deliver our true values. And those are values that I think all of us as Democrats share.
Our president spoke about the need for nonpartisanship and collaboration in Congress. Have you seen a change in the last few months? Are things getting better in the Congress?
No. Partly because all the medication taking members of the other party have been dismissed in primaries. I mean, there's actually a group called Club for Growth that runs against moderate Republicans. You saw Arlen Specter, who recently had his epiphany. His epiphany wasn't because he decided Democrats were such a great idea, although he had been one about 30 years ago. It was because his own party threatened him in a primary. He could win the general election. He couldn't survive the primary against his own party. He couldn't get the nomination. So he said, I think I'm just going to go switch. And so he did. So he became a Democrat. And whether he has a Democratic primary opponent, we'll see. But if he can survive the primary, he pretty much is assured to get his sixth term. So I think that, he's the exemplar for why partisan politics and purity among parties really gets rid of the vital center. And if you don't have a vital center that is willing to stand in the breach and say, look, let's get something done, let's try to find a way to soften the edges of this, let's try not to have this be so polarizing. Sometimes you can't avoid it, but optics, pitch, and tone are very important. And sometimes, as I tell my daughter, sometimes the way things look is almost more important than the way it is. And for politics especially, because we've had such a corrosive time over the last couple of decades, we look like lunatics sometimes, and we're made to look like lunatics. When we can stand up and say, look, we've worked together, and we've brought people together from opposing sides, and we have the vital center, then I think you're getting a better product, I think you're getting better public policy, and I think people that find an easy and convenient excuse for not participating have less of one, because they can't say, well, they never get along, and I'm proud to say in this district we have one of the highest voter turnouts in the country. Sometimes I say to my colleagues, well, I got 165,000 votes and you only got 50. Give me your voting card. I should get to vote for you. But I mean, that's a mandate, and that's why I think, and I've taken it for all these years, that moderate politics, being a moderate Democrat, was supported by my constituents because they wanted me, in the end, to do what's right, not just what was right for a Democrat.
For our digital audience, let me remind us that we're speaking with Congresswoman Ellen Tauscher, who's the nominee to be Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. One of the areas in which the New Dems, moderate Democrats, have often had a lot to say is the economy. Mm-hmm. And you also have this terrific background on Wall Street and starting a business and so on. Let's turn for a moment to the state of the economy. What do you see as the roots of the current economic downturn?
Well, obviously there's a lot of guilt to go around, and I can just tell you, one day in October, right after the crisis was really very amplified, we were all in Washington, and one of my colleagues came over to me and said, why do you think this is happening? And I said, the market was, you know, really having a significant downturn. And I said, well, you know, when I was on the New York Stock Exchange in 1977, I was 25 years old, and the average daily volume was 22 million shares, and the market was, you know, in the 875, 900 range, you know, three digits. And, you know, we were working physically very hard. I mean, we would come, we'd have a partners meeting in the morning, we would decide what the company strategy was for buying or selling or whatever, and then we would have all of these customer orders to do, and we had to physically do them. You had to physically pick the thing up and move it. So that was February of 1977. By August, the New York Stock Exchange started an experiment, a beta test, of computerized matching of 100 to 500 share market orders. So if you wanted to buy IBM at the market and you were just an individual investor, it would come not to me, but it would come to a central matching computer, and it would say IBM was selling at 100. The bid was 99 3/4, and the offer was 100, and the last sale was 100, and you would buy 100 shares for 100, and it would go up on the tape. Nobody touched it. Nothing happened. Within 10 days of the market, of us having this computerized system, the market went up, trading volume went up by 5 million shares. We hadn't moved in, you know, we were already moving pretty fast. By the time I left the New York Stock Exchange in 1980, the average daily volume was 100 million shares a day. Now, that's fine. But you know what the problem was? At the same time that the computer had aided the trading and it matched these orders and things were happening very efficiently, no one had written the software to be the regulator for that. And then, over the arc of the last 25 years, you had all of these financial products created, derivatives, son of derivatives, crazy, crazy derivative, unexplainable derivative, propeller head derivative, and nobody could understand really what they were. And when the market goes up, like everything else, everything's hunky-dory. But when things started to get a little shaky because the underpinnings of things were artificially inflated, all of a sudden, smart, really smart people, like I worked for the guy that was ended up to be the last guy standing at Bear Stearns. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met. He got brought in, and the guy that was running the firm basically said, I think we're really in trouble. He took over, and then that was it. And they couldn't do what's called mark-to-market. They couldn't figure out what something was valued at, because by the time you got to the antecedent product, it was way down over here, and the son of the derivative, the crazy propeller-headed derivative, whatever you were doing, was so far away from the real product, and the real product had been deflated in value for whatever market reasons. But there was no regulatory mechanism to keep up with what's going on. And that's really what's happened, is that we haven't had enough of a regulatory mechanism to keep up with markets that are going 24/7, completely global, with crazy products, son of derivative. And so now what we've had is the reality slap in the head that we maybe have to get back to basics. And we have to understand exactly how to put that international regime in of market regulation, because the human eye cannot track what's going on that the computer's doing. And, you know, I've been very critical of the Bush administration under the SEC. You know, they had complete areas of operation where people, lawyers weren't even hired. People, regulators weren't even watching the tape, so to speak. So you not only didn't have computer-aided regulatory regimes, but you didn't even have the people that were supposed to get the reports and understand them sitting at the desk. So I think we have to have a complete overhaul, and I know the speaker's talked about it, and I know the president has talked about it. But, you know, this is Humpty Dumpty, and we're going to have to figure out how to put Humpty Dumpty, a little different Humpty Dumpty, back together again.
Well, just picking up on your comment about Speaker Pelosi, it was last month at the Commonwealth Club that she announced that she would seek a so-called new PCORA commission. The PCORA commission was the commission that investigated Wall Street behavior and practices during the Great Depression, right, or during the crash. And so that is that the way to go to do a major investigation. Yes. Could you just elaborate a little bit on what that might involve and what you would hope to come out of that?
Well, we have to understand the basics of markets to begin with. And, you know, we've gone awry in a number of different places, including the fact that we had banking regulators and banks make decisions to go into products that were completely unsafe and completely without any real structural value, way to value things and way to keep your head on it. That, you know, there was a lot of effort to increase home ownership. We're all for home ownership, but we're certainly not for home ownership the way we've got it now. The subprime market debacle was just complete irresponsibility and no real regulatory oversight, not a lot of congressional oversight either. So there's a lot about that that I think we have to go back to our basics. You know, people cannot borrow more than they can pay back. And by the way, the government can't either. You know, we had to make some very radical, almost split-second decisions in the fall. I can remember being in a meeting with the speaker where she recounted what happened when then Secretary of the Treasury Paulson basically called up and said, I need $800 billion now. And she said, well, I think you better come up here. And they kind of sent over like a piece of paper that said, give me the money, and, you know, but we don't want any judicial review, and, you know, don't ask any questions. Mm-hmm. You know, this is really bad. We don't have time to tell you. Just give. And she said, no, I can't do that. And it was interesting, talk about partisanship, it was the Democrats that created the structure that we did the best we could. We basically said, we're not giving you all the money, we're only giving you half of the money, and we're going to put all these protections in, but you're not giving us a lot of time to make this good. And it was Democrats that passed it. It was a Republican president. And we were the ones that said, we better do this because they're telling us that the house is on fire and that they need to do this to turn the water on to save the house. So we're gonna put the protections in. They groused. They didn't want to do it. But we got very little Republican support to do it, either in the House or the Senate. And my attitude basically was, well, if your neighbor's house is on fire, you might not even like them. But in the end, your own self-interest should step in. And, you know, we had to do the Recovery Act, and we had to do the stimulus package. There were a number of things that we had to do, nothing that we really predicted. I can tell you that the president didn't think he would come into office and find himself in such extremis with a financial crisis and a number of other things that were going on. But, you know, I think that we've tried to manage it fairly well, and I think that there's a lot of improvement that we can do.
You certainly speak from a very informed background Wall Street practices from the inside. Let's talk a little bit about the transition from being a member of Congress to being in the executive branch. What do you expect to be a major difference between working as a congressperson and working as a member of the executive branch?
I'm not doing the job yet, although I do have all my clearances and all of that. I'm very excited to work in an administration led by Barack Obama. I find him to be one of the most compelling people I've ever met in my life, and he is not only very brilliant and very able to speak in a very congruent way about very vexing issues, but he is really about change, and he's really about trying to improve the political atmosphere. You know, a lot of the ethical issues and a lot of the background checks and stuff that he's put in take a lot more time than perhaps people want, but they're very, very important.
Yes, hundreds of pages of background material.
But it's, you know, it's nice to have passed. I figure I've either paid enough taxes or too much, and they're not going to give me the money back if I paid too much. But, you know, I think that in this administration, and certainly working for Secretary Clinton is very exciting. You know, it's a very, very big agenda. Every day that that you hear something, it's, you know, it's North Korea, it's Iran, it's Pakistan, it's this or that or the other thing. We've got in this undersecretariat that I would have, there's 600 people. There's a lot of different things going on. So, you know, if I'm confirmed, I think it's not dissimilar to my advocacy on behalf of my constituents. It's just that now it's one person named Barack Obama and another person named Hillary Clinton. And my job is to take the president and the secretary's agenda and what they believe is their policies for the American people and for our international partners, and to deal with our adversaries and to convince them that we're not kidding. And, you know, this is an extremely dangerous world. And I believe that as Commander-in-Chief, Barack Obama will show that he is someone with not only the spine, but with the sense of purpose to do things in a way that not only protect the American people, but protect our values, protect our reputation, and protect our sense of who we are. And we can have national security and at the same time have civil rights. We can have national security and at the same time remember that we are all human beings. And we can be very, very, very clear to our adversaries, don't even think about it, because we're not kidding. Because in the end, we're going to protect the American people, our forward deployed troops, our allies, and our assets. But we believe that there's a better way to do it than just offering our military up.
So on the to-do list, as you move towards this new position, what issue areas will you be dealing with just generally? Again, we need to steer clear of what policy directions right. and so on, but what are the big headline issues?
Well, the Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security has three bureaus with three assistant secretaries and eight or nine deputy assistant secretaries, number of envoys. Those different bureaus do the negotiations for the follow-on to the START Treaty, which is our verification treaty with the Russians on our dismantling and taking down of our nuclear weapon stockpiles. We have the cooperative threat reduction. We have obviously the chemical and biological treaties. We have the non-proliferation treaty review. We negotiate how we go forward on that. That's just this one area called verification, compliance, and inspection. We have another bureau called ISN. It's basically international security and non-proliferation. They do all of the cooperative agreements with various countries. They work to make sure that we have a strong civil nuclear reactor cooperative agreements, and they do a lot of inspections, and they work with the IAEA. We have a third bureau called political military. We are the bridge between the State Department and the Department of Defense. We have a number of people that work for, they're diplomats that work for the combatant commanders, Strategic Command, Southern Command, Pacific Command, and we have a number of people put through the different military places. We deal with things like piracy and other things. So we're the State Department, we're the foreign policy point of view and voice of the administration. And we intersect with anybody that has anything to say about public policy or how the United States does things. We have a number of, it's about 600 people, as I said earlier, many foreign service officers. We're called T. The undersecretary is called T, and then it's the T family. And it's a fascinating set of issues and lots of very timely things.
Such as, let me just mention a few, Iran's nuclear weapons aspirations, North Korea's nuclear policies, and so on. It is truly some of the most dangerous, interesting, and hopefully soluble problems that the U.S. faces in our foreign and defense policy. So,
thank you.
Congratulations on being offered such an important role.
Thank you.
There are a number of questions from the audience, and many of them are in this area. So, again, please feel free to just indicate if you can't go there. One question has to do, we spoke about this a little bit earlier, the four leaders, former leaders, Sam Nunn, Bill Perry, George Shultz, and Henry Kissinger, who have been very vocal in talking about the need to make major reductions in nuclear weapons. The question simply is, will you be working with this group to control and eliminate nuclear weapons around the world?
Well, you know, I can talk to you as the Congresswoman now, the Chair of Strategic Forces. Back in August of 2006, General James Cartwright, who is a four-star Marine, who's now the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. At the time, he was the combatant commander for the Strategic Command. He and I went to Stanford University to meet with Bill, with George Shultz, who is a friend and someone who I think is an exemplar of bipartisanship. And I asked him to help me as a politician, as a woman, and a Democrat, which are three bad things in some places. I thought it would be important that if we could get a bipartisan group of wise men and women to step forward and talk about the opportunity to reduce our nuclear weapons stockpile strategically and tactically and to go to zero. Sometimes when you hear people talk about it, and if you read or heard about the president's speech in Prague last month, if those of you who haven't seen it, you can probably go to the White House website, but it's the president's speech in Prague and where he talked about nonproliferation and a number of other things, our nuclear posture. Currently, the United States government is going through three strategic reviews. One is our nuclear posture review. It's due in December. We're going through what's called the quadrennial defense review. It is just what you think it is. It's a four-year review of our our defense posture. And then we just had a report by what's called the Strategic Posture Review. Bill Perry was the chairman. Jim Schlesinger, a former Secretary of Defense and Energy, Republican, wonderful guy, was the vice chairman. That came out of my subcommittee. So we have a delivery of a number of strategic reviews on our nuclear posture, on nonproliferation, on the worth of deterrence, on a number of different things. And those will inform the administration as to the president's posture on a number of things. But the president's made very clear, especially in this speech in Prague, that that we want to get back to what we all call the high ground. The United States is a signatory to the Nonproliferation Treaty. Article 6 of the Nonproliferation Treaty says that those states that have nuclear weapons will go to zero. The ambition is to go to zero. So you hear out in the debate lots of people on the far side of one party that will say how dangerous and how irresponsible it is for the president to talk about going to zero on nuclear weapons. Ladies and gentlemen, we signed that treaty a long time ago. We've said we were going to do that. The question is, as the rest of the world watches, are we actually going to do it? Are we actually going to look like we're doing it? That's optics. Optics, pitch, and tone. Are we actually going to start to do the things that say that we are going to do it? That's why the follow-on treaty to start negotiations for the Russians is very, very important. We have the two largest arsenals. We have got to say to people that have ambitions and aspirations to have nuclear weapons, hold it, hold it, hold it. We're going down. There's no reason for you to be threatened by us. We're going down. At the same time, we have a very strong conventional force. We have a conventional military, and we have conventional armaments that we can use that are enormously precise and very, very effective should we find ourselves in a place where the president as commander-in-chief decides he must use them. So the idea that Barack Obama or his administration is looking to weaken the United States, that's not true. What he's decided to do, as he says in his Prague speech, is to live up to our commitments and to lead the world away from these very, very dangerous weapons, because the more there are of them, the less able we are to safeguard them and protect them. That's the simple fact. And since we have the most, we should be the ones that are visibly doing the best we can to make sure that we are not only safeguarding them, but that we are taking them down. And taking them down, I mean destroying them. I don't mean putting them on blocks in a garage, which is what the Bush administration did in the last few years. You have to destroy them. And so we have to do things that very visibly show that we understand what our commitments are, that we once again are going to lead the world in this effort, that we are our partner, Russia, and others, we're going to work together. So I think the president's agenda, if you read the Prague speech, is very clear. He is a man who is committed, taking an oath to do it, to protect the American people. But at the same time, The proliferation of these weapons is enormously dangerous. It is uncontrollable at some level. It is the wrong direction, and that we're going to lead in the effort to make sure that we are not making the world less safe because we haven't done what we promised to do, which is to have a weapons stockpile that is being reduced responsibly.
And just to add, that, of course, has been the policy, bipartisan policy, of every administration since the Kennedy administration. Mm-hmm. Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Bush 1, et cetera. Right. So it's simply returning to our history and progression in that direction, of course, in a verifiable manner with other countries as our partners and so on.
That's
so shouldn't be that controversial.
That's right.
Let's come back home here, leaving you to move into those issues in your future. And let's look here in the district for a moment. What do you see as the major issues your successor will need to tackle here in the district, and in what directions do you hope that person might move on the issues that you're leaving behind?
Well, you know, I think that both the Armed Services Committee and the Transportation Committee are the right purchase for the person that wins the special election. We still have to build the Caldecott Tunnel, Fourth Poor. We got the money, but, you know, we're still moving forward. We had the successful resolution of a lawsuit that had stopped us for a while from the other side, so now we're, I think, ready to go. We were able to bring in a lot of money from the stimulus package for ready-to-go projects. I've worked very closely together with Will Kempton, who's the head of our Caltrans. I was able to, you know, as the senior member from California, the speaker asked me to kind of take the lead in statewide efforts on the reauthorization of what's called the Surface Transportation Act, and it's coming up this year. So it's important that we do everything we can to make sure we not only get our fair share, but we've been influential in two different areas. One is alternatives and enhancements to make sure that our California lifestyle are the things that we're projecting around the country and that we're getting rewarded for that by getting our money back. So bike trails, many of the different things that you see us doing here in California, we want to get rewarded for that. We don't just want to build, you know, roads and rails, although that's important and we spend a lot of money to do that, but we want diversification and we want more control over our money. And the second thing is, obviously, we care a lot about water quality and air quality, and we want to make sure that we in California have the flexibility to do the things that we want to do to make sure that we are getting invested the way we want. If you remember MTBE, the issue with the additive to gasoline, you know, there's a lot in Congress that isn't really working for us at times. We have a lot of people that have an ABC attitude. That's anything but California. Now, we've got 53 House members. We've got the Speaker of the House as a Californian. We've got the great Senator Feinstein, very good Senator Boxer. And, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, that's we still are only what we are, and there's still a lot of people out there that say, oh, you know, I'm not California. And what we have to do is make our case to the administration and others. And clearly, an area where Gloria's husband works very successfully in high-speed rail, we had a California initiative. Californians said, let's do this. And President Obama came out within a few days of his administration and said, you know what, I want to not only help California with high-speed rail, but I want to make sure that we do this around the country because we think this is a very efficient way of moving people and goods in much more of a safe and much more environmentally secure way. So I think that there's a lot that needs to be done in the district. I've done everything I can up until the moment that I go, but when I do go, there's still a lot of work to be done. But it needs political will, and that's why you're so very important. That's why having such great voter turnout is so very important, because I can go back and say, my constituents aren't confused about this. They're not wishy-washy about this. They voted enormously for these projects. The fact that we here in the Bay Area have taxed ourselves to spend money directly on transportation projects says that we are very, very interested in not only using our tax dollars from Washington, from our gas tax, but that we really believe this is important. We think congestion is bad for the air and for water quality. We think it's bad for safety. We don't think that moms and dads who are working hard need to spend an extra 45 minutes on the road just because they can't get from point A to point B. That's time they need to be with their family. So we want to make sure that we're making the right investments here in the Bay Area. So I think that that's one of the most important things.
You mentioned earlier that the federal government needed to live within its means. Any comment on the current California budget situation?
Well, you know, some of the problems, the antecedent problem, I believe, is certainly Prop 13. And I think that we found ourselves with an unworkable governing model. And whether we have a constitutional convention, I would support that. I think that we have got to have serious and sober people articulate exactly how we get ourselves out of the box we're in. You cannot have a minority who is going to fall on the ball and claim that they are gaining ground and deny the ability to move the budget forward every year for the last 30 years. You just can't have that. And, you know, you have to have a way for people to be practical and commonsensical. I also am deeply concerned about the initiative process. I've got a lot of friends in government up in Sacramento, but by the way, that's what you sent them there for. And, you know, these are decisions. Look, I can write an initiative question that will actually have you harm your own self-interest, and you'd be for it. But I can write, you know, there are people that are very good at that, and they're hired by people putting these initiatives on the California ballot all day long. So I think people have to stand up and start to say, this is a crazy house, and we cannot operate ourselves this way. This is an embarrassment. We are not helping ourselves. We're growing a baby California. There's probably another 12 million people coming to California in the next 25 years. We have water problems. We have economic problems. We have health and safety issues. We've got an economy that is still the engine of the new economy. We have more opportunity and more reason to get it right than anybody else. But right now we have a government structure that is crazy. And we have got to start to understand that nobody's going to come in from Nevada and help us fix this. They're cheering at the border. You know, oh, you know, people in California can't get it right. We've got to get this right, and it's going to take people standing up and saying, it's got to make sense. Let's figure out how to do this, and let's go. And you're going to, you know, it's going to be leadership that you're going to have to find.
Because it's so fundamental to the national labs in this district, to our competitiveness in the global economy, and even to the work you're going to be doing in the arms control field, I think this audience member's question is important. How will we grow and increase the number of scientists and engineers in this country? We don't have enough to sustain our technological advantage now.
No, that's absolutely right. You know, the best thing to do is, you know, we have some of the finest schools in the state of California and in the country in this district. It's because the people of this district require it. And they basically have made the decision that they're going to have excellent public schools in this district. And everybody's got problems and nothing's perfect, but there's a reason why we have higher housing values and the kind of success that people have in this area. It's because people, the parents that come here and the grandparents that come here, understand that they are different than their siblings and the people that they went to high school with because of their education. They understand that it is a key predictor in the success of average people in this country. And we've made choices here. What we can't have is a California education system where people flying in an airplane have, you know, when Jim used to be a captain for Delta, if he got on the plane and said, ladies and gentlemen, we have to land in Oakland because we have a light on or off, and have everybody in coach start screaming, not Oakland, they don't know how to read there. But what, you know, but do we actually think that we have the excellence and rigor in our public school system in California? The numbers are staggering. The dropout rate in some parts of the state is 60%. That is a very big load to carry. Because when those people don't graduate, they don't leave California, they stay. And those are not the shoulders that we're going to build a 21st economy on. So from the very beginning, you know, I believe that we need to have preschool for young people. We know what it means to have young people that are able to sit in class and listen, that are able to be ready to be educated. And for some people, that means preschool is necessary. means that we have to have requirements for how kids are getting through school. And it's not about teaching to the test. It's about excellence and rigor. And it's about having the finest teachers that are well paid but are measured. And they're measured by the accomplishments of their students, not just by testing, but by the success of those people in the future. But we are people that can make those decisions because we've not only seen the movie, but we've starred in it. We know what this looks like, but we've got to make the decision to pay for it. And that is a decision that Californians are going to have to make. Because if you don't have an excellent education system, remember when we had AAA bonds? We also had the most successful public school system in the country in the 60s. Where did it go? Well, you know where it went? We starved it. We starved it for money. And we made some bad choices. Now, we're big enough and smart enough to turn it around because we are so vital and we are so successful in many ways. But unless California decides that it's going to have the finest science teachers, the finest engineering students, the finest math students, and people that can write a declarative sentence, make an argument, and actually listen and understand how to comport themselves, we're not going to be anything but a big something that used to be really great. And I think that we still have time to do that. It takes leadership and it takes commitment. It also takes discipline. And I think that we need more discipline in our system.
Thank you for those words of wisdom. The very best to you as you go
Thank
off
you,
into
Gloria.
A very challenging position, but
you.
One in which I know you're going to have success and which will be very rewarding.
I appreciate that.
So
Thank
our
you.
Thanks to Congresswoman Ellen Tauscher
Thank
in
you.
What are likely her last days as the representative in Congress from mm-hmm. this district. Our thanks to our audience here in Lafayette and on the radio, television, on the internet. The very best of luck to you.
Thank you.
I'm Gloria Duffy, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.